Also on this Earth Day, the world's greenest office building officially opens its doors. It's called the Bullitt Center, and it's an ambitious project by the environmentally progressive Bullitt Foundation. The goal here is to showcase an office building that is said to be entirely self-sustaining in energy and environmentally friendly in many other ways. The developers are hoping for a copycat effect here. But first, more on the new building from NPR's Wendy Kaufman in Seattle.
The first thing that strikes you about the new Bullitt Center is the windows. Walking up to the building in the city's Capitol Hill neighborhood, six stories of floor-to-ceiling glass soars above you. You notice I said walking up to the building. There's no on-site parking, and once inside, there's more walking.
In a building this size, any place else in Seattle, it would have two elevators, and that's what would face you as you walked in the front door. Here, the stairway is obvious, and it's attractive.
That's Dennis Hayes, president and CEO of the Seattle-based Bullitt Foundation. He explains there is an elevator, but it's tucked away. The staircase encourages exercise, and the concept saves money both in energy use and construction costs. This is but one of dozens of decisions and trade-offs that went into the building, a building Dennis Hayes describes as a living organism.
It has eyes, it has ears, it has a nervous system, it has a brain, and it responds to its environment in a way that seeks to optimize things.
He points across the street to a mini weather station. It sends data back to the building so it can decide what it should do to maximize comfort and conserve energy.
Whether the windows should be open or should be closed, and whether the external shutters should be down or should be up, and if they're down, what angle they should be at to reflect as much sunlight as possible, as far as possible, into the building to give you daylighting at your desk.
Just about everything in this building is off-the-shelf technology, from photovoltaic cells on the roof to composting toilets. But never before has all the technology been integrated into a single building in quite this way.
I think it's fair to say that we were all a bit skeptical in the beginning.
Chris Rogers is the founding partner of Point 32, the firm that developed the $30 million project in conjunction with the Bullitt Foundation. Rogers and the others set out to meet the rigorous goals of the Living Building Challenge, including total self-sufficiency in energy and water and building materials that are free of toxins.
So down here in the basement is where you'll find the majority of the building systems, our composting toilet system, our underground water storage cistern.
But beyond the systems, the 160 or so people working inside will have a huge role in meeting the sustainability targets. The foundation occupies half of the top floor. The rest of the building is being leased out. The rent, market rate for a top-tier building, though many amenities you might expect for the price don't exist. And tenants have to live within an energy budget. Rob Pena of the University of Washington's Integrated Design Lab says energy use can be measured down to the individual socket.
That's quite unusual. There probably isn't a building in the country that's metered to the level this building is metered.
Clearly, this building is not for everyone. If you think of this simply as an office building, it was relatively expensive to design and build. But if you view it as a laboratory, an educational center, and a bold effort to change how things are built, the calculus changes. Still, one could ask, is it possible to replicate the self-sustaining features at a reasonable cost?
If this building isn't replicable, then this experiment will have failed.
Developer Chris Rogers is optimistic others will follow their lead. He points out that over the past couple of decades, many builders began incorporating green elements into their buildings. And Chris Cole, a construction cost analyst at the global engineering firm AECOM, adds,
the market changed. The market started to expect new buildings to have some of these features.
And the supply chain began to adapt. New products and services were created, and some costs began to fall. Cole believes the Bullitt project could foster additional shifts in the marketplace.
As businesses and organizations seek to clean up their footprint,
trade-offs between cost, fancy features, and sustainability will undoubtedly be made, and developers and tenants will make those decisions differently. Still, the Bullitt Foundation is encouraged by all the attention their building is getting from people around the world. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
Okay, now the suspects in the bombing have been identified as two brothers from the Russian Republic of Chechnya. One is dead, the other loose, as we've been hearing. We do not know what their motives are. We do know that this unfolded when the FBI first released photos and video yesterday of these two suspects who appeared in these images near the scene of the Boston Marathon bombing on Monday. Later, one of them turned up in a surveillance video robbing a 7-Eleven last night, starting the events that have continued. Federal officials sifted through terabytes of data, and as NPR's Steve Henn reports, new technology is making it easier to search like this.
In today's society, there are sensors almost everywhere. And I'm not just talking about surveillance cameras, or even things like automatic license plate readers. Most of us walk around with a cell phone in our pocket, and it comes complete with a camera and microphone of its own. So anytime you're in a crowd, chances are someone is rolling. So in Boston, Timothy Albin, who heads up the Massachusetts State Police, asked for help the day after the attack.
There have to be hundreds, if not thousands, of photographs or videos or observations that were made down at that finish line yesterday. And I would encourage you to bring forward anything. You might not think it's significant, but it might have some value to this investigation.
Albin clearly saw all these recordings as an opportunity for investigators, but the sheer volume also posed a challenge.
The availability of electronic data, in this case, video data, still photo data, cellular calling records, cell tower records.
Brian Cunningham has worked at the CIA, the U.S. Department of Justice, and on the National Security Staff at the White House. Today, he says, some of this information can be enormously valuable, but the quantity can be overwhelming.
Most people don't understand that putting more cameras doesn't necessarily yield more information.
Alan Shipp is the CEO of a company in San Francisco called 3VR. One of its first investors was InQtel, the CIA's venture capital fund. 3VR specializes in computerized video analytics, like facial recognition and object tracking. Shipp says often when investigators comb through videotapes, they're facing an information glut.
So what we've done is we've indexed that information. So when we do video, we extract things like size, shape, color, speed, direction, and let you search against that and point back to the video. So instead of watching hours and maybe days of video, you can ask questions like, show me all red cars that went east.
Or look for anyone wearing a white baseball cap, like the suspect who allegedly set down his backpack at the site of the second explosion. Diego Simkin at 3VR says if you have high enough resolution images, their software can search by age or gender. He runs a search on the company's own security cameras looking for men.
We'll do 20 to 25.
It's pretty fine-grained.
Yeah.
One of the hits is him.
How old are you?
I'm actually 28.
Not bad, but it's not perfect. And Shipp says this technology works best in controlled environments.
Well, there are limitations. And so, you know, one thing that this technology has had a history of is over-promising and under-delivering.
The tools investigators have today are much more powerful than they were just a few years ago. But some who work in this field, like Amit Gavish, say the scene in Boston before the blast posed a challenge. It was crowded. A bit chaotic.
Deploying analytics at that moment or using it for that specific moment is extremely difficult for computer vision technologies.
At best, technologies like this make the work of human analysts go faster, perhaps help them find more images of their suspects, images they might otherwise have missed. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
We'll continue to bring you the latest throughout this morning right here on Morning Edition from NPR News.
When it comes to technology, Philadelphia is no Silicon Valley, and the organizers of the third annual Philly Tech Week say it's not trying to be. However, to kick off the week-long celebration of the local tech scene, organizers have turned a skyscraper into an interactive video game. From member station WHYY, Zach Seward reports.
So we're on the steps of the Philadelphia Art Museum, looking across the Schuylkill River. What are we looking at right now?
We're looking at the Cira Center, which is a 29-story building that will soon be the world's biggest video game.
That's Frank Lee. He's a professor at Drexel University and the co-founder of the school's game design program. He's also the man behind this gigantic version of the video game Pong. About a half mile from where we're standing, a lattice of LED lights on a wall of mirrored glass is serving as the pixels on what you might call a 400-foot-tall screen. Lee says the vision for his tech art mashup came when he was driving by one day.
Other times I pass by, I didn't really think too much about it, but this time in 2008, when I was passing by, I saw Tetris shapes rotating and falling, and that began this long journey to make this game.
5 years later, his vision has morphed into the giant ping pong video game. A few hundred people gathered Friday night to watch gamers actually face off in an arcade classic that was older than most in attendance. About 1,000 people entered an online lottery to play the game.
Ticket 30 through 40 over here!
Two of the winners step up to the joysticks. The game begins, complete with vintage sound effects.
3, 2, 1...
The old-school joystick panel is connected to a laptop, which is connected to a 4G hotspot, which is linked wirelessly to the computers that control the building's lights.
Look at that. And left paddle might take it. Yes, it does.
Craig Getting is a theater director and teacher in Philadelphia. He's also a pretty decent color commentator.
Oh, that never wins. Left paddle wins. 5-3. Pong.
17-year-old Darren Davis was the winner of that friendly matchup. He says playing a video game on a skyscraper was pretty cool.
To be honest, taking my hands on a joystick, it was pretty amazing. I actually really liked it.
Davis is a high school junior by day, but a game developer by night. The idea of Tech Week is to encourage Philadelphians to up the ante, then it worked on Davis.
It definitely is inspiration to make me want to top this, because I know I can.
Organizer Christopher Wink says inspiration like that is the whole point. Wink runs the local tech blog that's organizing Philly Tech Week. Pong is just the kickoff to a slew of 100-plus tech-related events. But Wink says the game is also a symbol of the momentum he's hoping to build around Philly's growing tech scene.
When you look at a skyline that is the embodiment of infrastructure, that it can move as a symbol for what Philadelphia can do. We can make Philadelphia whatever we want to be.
After dozens of competitors squared off on the face of a skyscraper, the video game was shut down for the night. But the opportunities for tech-induced wonder aren't done yet. Round 2 of Pong is on for Wednesday. For NPR News, I'm Zach Seward in Philadelphia.
This is NPR News.
Now, online streaming is playing a bigger and bigger role in news events. Many people listened and watched the Boston bombing coverage on their laptops. And on Friday night, as the manhunt came to a close, tens of thousands of people were listening to police dispatches live online. In the entertainment world, video streaming is also having a big impact. Try this. It's estimated that Netflix alone takes up a third of U.S. bandwidth between 9 p.m. and midnight. That's a lot. Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime all feature two kinds of programming, the movies and shows they all have, like, for example, Lost, and a few things they have exclusively. In the case of Netflix, that could mean making and exclusively streaming the new season of a cult favorite.
It's arrested development.
In today's Business Bottom Line, NPR's Neda Ulaby says video streaming services seem to be adopting a strategy that was pioneered by pay cable.
Not too long ago, Annette Isaacson and her husband finally got around to watching the BBC show Downton Abbey on Netflix.
And we kind of got hooked on the show.
The Isaacsons streamed the first season, but Netflix did not have the second one.
So we went out and subscribed with Hulu so we could basically watch that season.
The Isaacsons joined Hulu Plus just to see what happened to Lady Mary and Cousin Matthew, since they could not stream it on Netflix, a service they already had.
I don't believe Matthew has any desire to stop her marrying Richard.
Maybe. But is she as convinced as he is that they have no future?
As you can imagine, the fight among video streaming services for Downton Abbey has been intense. They don't need casual watchers. They need passionate fans. People who need to see their Downton Abbey no matter what. A few months ago, Amazon Prime bought the rights to stream it exclusively. So soon that will be the only place to watch it. But research analyst Michael Pachter of Weber Securities says maybe that's not the best way to attract new subscribers.
Exclusives are going to mean more if they are truly exclusive.
meaning the only place you can watch them ever is on Hulu or Netflix or Amazon Prime. That means paying more to make exclusive original content. Pachter thinks the trade-off's worth it. Look at HBO.
The only show I remember watching on HBO in the 90s was The Larry Sanders Show.
So why do you want to work on this show as opposed to, Jay Leno?
I like this show better.
At the time, Larry Sanders Show was an exception, a rare original series on a channel then dominated by movies people had already seen in the theaters.
Now, I literally watch Boardwalk Empire, Newsroom, you know, Game of Thrones, I mean, at Veep. They've just got me hooked.
That's a strategy Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime are trying to emulate, says Pachter. Now, those services have two kinds of exclusives, ones they've bought the rights to, like Downton Abbey, and the ones they make themselves. Netflix and Hulu are not exactly competing with HBO when it comes to original programming, at least not yet, says Hulu's Senior Vice President of Content, Andy Frisell.
Increasingly, I think people are coming to services like Hulu to discover something new.
Hulu's slowly growing its slate of original series, including soon its first animated one.
I am Professor Dr. Awesome, also known as PROC, which is short for Professor Doctor, and I am the new leader of the Awesomes.
Whether Frisell is developing an original program like The Awesomes or negotiating an exclusive for an established show, he says he's looking for exactly the same thing.
We want to find things that are familiar enough in the context of last night's TV and that can stand up and look totally at home against the best of what was on TV last night.
So that might be Downton Abbey or just something that seems like Downton Abbey. Research analyst Michael Pachter says the real question is, will subscribers join these services
for a week or a month or a quarter and then churn back out?
That's what happened with Annette Isaacson and her husband with Hulu Plus. Once they finished watching Downton Abbey's second season, they canceled their subscription. When I asked if she was tempted by any of their other exclusives, she said, no. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
On a Monday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Today, in Your Health, we're going to look at fraudulent insurance schemes that are popping up all over the country as the health system undergoes some major changes. But first, young adults in the autism spectrum and the obstacles they face in the job market. Lauren Silverman from member station KERA in Dallas looks at one place where they are finding work, in high tech.
Amelia Schaubel graduated from high school 5 years ago. She had good grades and enrolled in community college, but it was too stressful. After less than a month, she was back at home doing...
nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Schaubel has Asperger syndrome, a disorder on the high-functioning end of the autism spectrum. For people like her, interacting socially can be a challenge.
I can look someone in the eye and talk to them, but I don't always understand the work, and I don't know who to ask for help, or if someone, you know, doesn't treat me the way I think I deserve to be treated, I'm not going to react well. I may lash out, I may not speak to them, I may just glare.
This year alone, 50,000 adolescents with autism will turn 18.
It's staggering to think about the number of children that will be aging out of the school system in the next 15 years with autism that really aren't going to have a place to go.
That's Gary Moore. His son Andrew is a junior in high school and has autism. Moore used to stay up at night worrying about what would happen to Andrew after graduation.
Although he can't tie his shoes or buckle his belt or do a lot of things independently, he can do technology. And so I'd been watching my son his whole life play on the computer, play video games, and I saw all this ability.
So Moore decided to pair up with another parent of an autistic teen to create what they see as the future for kids like theirs. It's a training program and a software company called the Nonpareil Institute in Plano, Texas.
Are we going to the left?
More than 100 young adults on the autism spectrum are students here. They get training in software programming, digital design, and 3D modeling. Two dozen work as employees. Aaron Winston, who's 21, has been at Nonpareil 2 years.
I knew I wanted to be in the video game industry, but they said, oh, you have to go to college.
And he tried, but says it was overwhelming navigating the large campus, crowded classes, and new social situations.
I don't think I'd be very successful at college, but Nonpareil allows me to be successful here.
Last year, Winston designed and programmed a game called Space Ape that's available on iTunes. In the game, you help a little Russian cosmonaut lost in space. Nonpareil already has other apps in the iTunes store and on Google Play, and seven more in the works.
I really do feel like this is an untapped labor market.
Jim Pierce is with Alliance Data, a Fortune 500 company in Plano that's hired nearly a dozen people with cognitive disabilities.
we've got this one guy, his productivity level is three times as productive as the person doing his job that did not have cognitive disabilities before him. And his error rate is 2%. He's 98% accurate. He's a phenomenal worker.
Pierce thinks it won't be long before more companies realize they're missing out on a hiring opportunity. Dr. Patricia Evans of Children's Medical Center in Dallas says jobs in the tech sector can be a perfect fit for people with autism because of their ability to hyper-focus on an assignment.
They may really flourish at engineering-type tasks or computer design-type tasks where their interaction with people is somewhat limited.
Ultimately, Dr. Evans says whether someone ends up doing data analysis for a Fortune 500 company or programming video games at a startup like Nonpareil isn't what matters. What's important is making it easier for young adults with autism to transition out of school and into the working world. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Silverman.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The suspects in the Boston Marathon bombings have been identified as ethnic Chechen immigrants. So you might be wondering, what, if anything, does that have to do with any alleged behavior that they were participating in? We'll find out more about Chechnya's history and politics in just a few minutes. But first, we want to take a look at the role social media has played in the investigation and coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings. Both the Boston FBI and the Boston Police Department have chosen Twitter as one of their main ways to communicate with the press and the public. But in addition to the useful information they gathered via these means, many Facebook pages, Twitter feeds, and comment sections of news stories have been littered with threats, slurs, and hate speech directed at Muslims or anybody with a perceived connection to the suspects. And a lot of that was happening even before they were identified. We wanted to talk more about what this might mean. So we've called Michael Skolnick. He's the editor-in-chief of GlobalGrind.com. That's a news and entertainment site founded by Russell Simmons. He tweeted about the bombings more than 400 times last week and talked about some of this kind of content. Also joining us, Roy Junco. He's a faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And we often call upon him to talk about some of the trends on social media. Welcome back to you both. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Michelle. Great to be here.
Michael, what have you seen on your site? I know that you talked about the kind of the vitriol and hatred you were seeing on other sites, but what about on your own site?
I think that anytime during situations like this where there are folks involved who have been targeted in the past, especially in this country, we see some of the nastiness and some of the worst part of those who live in this country and across this world. And our site, we didn't see so much hate. We saw a lot of confusion, a lot of answers. Most folks had never even heard of Chechnya and wanted to know where Chechnya was and what happens in Chechnya and who the Chechens are and what the history of Chechnya is. So we did a lot of explanation, a lot of explaining to folks. But I think for the most part, young people that I saw across the board wanted answers and certainly went to social media and went to the blogs and went to the internet to get answers because they weren't getting them from traditional media.
Roy Junco, what about that? I mean, the comment sections, I think I can say this based on personal experience, the comment sections of a lot of news sites are often a place where people want to go to deliver nasty, you know, messages about anything. And so I wanted to ask if the kind of comments that you saw in the wake of the bombing were in fact unusual, or was there another level to them?
Well, I see it as something that happens, you know, generally online. I think right after a traumatic event is a perfect time for the trolls to come out. So this is, you know, people are disgusted, sick, sad, mourning, they're shocked. Trolling would get an even bigger rise out of people, and I think that certainly plays a role after such an event. I think also, you know, separate from trolling but related is that it can be a way to get attention, that, you know, there's a stark contrast between posting a hateful comment and what most people are posting. And I think that we've talked about this before on the show, that online there's a barrier between the communicator and everybody else. It's called the online disinhibition effect. So people are able to vent and get catharsis without an immediate physical response. Like in face-to-face situations, we often get, to use an operant conditioning term, punished when we vent inappropriate statements. Yeah. Online, the opposite may occur. The person who is likely to post a hate speech experiences an echo chamber where they get others with similar beliefs who are following them or reading their comments to support their message.
And when you say trolls, could you just clarify that for people who haven't heard that term before?
Sure. And trolls and trolling is basically getting a rise out of people, people who go online and really just want to get a reaction from people. They really are not connected to their own sense of empathy and are really just looking to make people upset or angry.
And I have to ask, though, because, you know, in the real world, in real life, people just generally can't in your life go around just saying mean things for no reason to people
right.
without getting some kind of reaction. Do you think that trolling is a significant part of why some people are online to begin with, because they just want to vent for whatever reason, or that this is how they want to express themselves and they enjoy it?
I think there's a minority of the online population that is online to do that.
Okay. Michael, at one point, you sent a tweet that identified a pair of carjackers believed to have been the Chernyov brothers as Middle Eastern suspects who are armed, even though you put Middle Eastern in quotes. Tell me about what goes into a decision like that.
That was a quote directly from the police scanner. That's what they were saying over. So that was a quote directly from the police. The carjacking victim had said that to the police. A lot of folks have said the carjacking victim hasn't spoken. He spoke to the police right after he was carjacked. I think what was interesting, Michelle, was that night I was awake and I saw on Twitter that there was a shooting at MIT campus, and I turned on all the traditional network news and nobody was covering it. For 45 minutes, no one had anything live from the scene, and all that we had was police scanners, folks, you know, on Twitter, students at MIT. And so we are gathering pieces of information. It was first a shooting at MIT, then there's a 7-Eleven possible robbery, then there's a carjacking victim, then there was a going to a DoubleTree hotel, then they were going to New York, then there was a stolen SUV, and then there was shots fired, grenades, explosives in Watertown. And this was before any network news had even was starting covering it. So we were just getting pieces of information, trying to piece it together. So when that Middle Eastern term came up over the police scanner, I certainly want to say it didn't come from me, because I didn't see the two gentlemen.
But I think what you're saying, though, what you're pointing out is in a lot of ways we're experiencing these events in real time. And so people are giving the information that they have essentially without a filter. And that has its pluses and its minuses.
Absolutely. So. If you look at the Boston Globe, who did an incredible job of covering this event, their Friday paper is already printed. And what do you do when the Boston Globe, they were the ones who broke that these two guys were actually the ones who they were looking for, actually the Marathon bombing suspects. And what do you do when your paper is already printed? You go online and you have to put something online immediately, because folks are reading at 4 o'clock in the morning. We were up all night tweeting and Facebooking and putting on our website. They wanted information in real time. When I was watching the news, they were 15, 20 minutes behind on Friday night when they're getting the guy. So Twitter served as a purpose to give everyone information as it was happening.
And right to the point of this whole question of the kinds of messages that people are giving out and the concerns that they have about them, I mean, the fact is that we also talked about this in this program. We're all aware of the misinformation that made it into the traditional media, including a newspaper who identified the wrong people as suspects more than once. And the other thing that people have pointed out is that people often use the same social media tools that they're using to spread vitriol to counteract those messages, and other people challenge them. Other people challenge the kinds of comments that are being. So when you look at all of that together, I'm asking you, Ray, what do you think the net effect is of that? Do you think that the net effect, what's the overall narrative that you get? Is it that people use it to vent, or that they use it to correct, or do they cancel each other out? Do you have a picture in the mind or a metaphor that you can give us about this?
My sense is the overall narrative is that people use it to connect and to engage with others in productive ways, and there are some people who use it to vent. I would say, you know, if I had to put a number to it, and please don't quote me on this because I haven't looked at the data, it would be almost impossible to look at the data, but I would say it's probably, you know, 80-20 or 90-10, that 80% or 90% are using social media for very productive purposes.
And the 10% just looms large, or the 10 or 15% just looms large for whatever reason.
Well, sure. And you know, when we label it as venting, it could be anything from, you know, venting like, oh, wow, this, you know, this happened to me today, to the trolling that we're talking about. And I think that some of that venting can serve a purpose, not the trolling, but I think some of the venting can serve a purpose, because then people can get support from others.
Well, I was thinking, and when I was using that term, I was thinking specifically about people who had kind of made these racist assumptions even before any credible information had been rendered about who was responsible for this,
sure.
including threats to whole groups of people, suggesting that, you know, a whole group of people ought to be, you know, hurt or harmed as a consequence. Michael, we only have about a minute left. Is there anything you learned from this as a kind of a avid practitioner of social media? I mean, you basically live on Twitter. I'm thankful you're here today, but that you've learned from this. Is there anything you'd do differently in the future?
I think there were some mistakes made on social media. As you said, there were mistakes made in traditional media as well. I think that that is a learning lesson of how we move forward, of who wants to be first and how to get information first. But I think the positive thing, what I saw so many new people on Twitter who started following me, who had one follower, so you know they're new. They just wanted the information very quickly. This will be a day that we will remember, as media will drastically change in this country, and traditional media will have to figure out how to compete with real-time news.
Michael Skolnick is the editor-in-chief of GlobalGrind.com. That's a news and entertainment site founded by Russell Simmons. He joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. You have what? How many Twitter followers? Like a million?
About
a million.
I have a lot. Follow me. Come check me out, and we'll have a good time on Twitter.
Ray, he was here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Ray Junco was with us. He's a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He was kind enough to join us on the phone from his office. Ray, thank you so much for joining us also.
Thank you, Michelle.